This is the Functional Nerds, episode number 32. My name's Patrick Hester, and hey, I'm awake after a very long weekend, so that's progress. Say hello, John.
Hey, I'm John Anilio. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy. I also have a video blog over at Wired Magazine's Geek Dad blog called Geek Dad Guitar Lessons. Tonight, we have a really special guest. He is the author of two books. His first book was The Physics of Superheroes, which then led to him as a advisory gig on the Watchmen movie. And he's got a new book out called The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, a math-free exploration of the science that made our world. And this and the author of this is Jim Kekalius. Say hello, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thanks for joining us. You know, before we get started, why don't you tell us a little something about...
Wait, before you do that, do you love or hate The Big Bang Theory?
Oh, I love it. I like the show.
Oh, yeah, I forgot there's a show.
Cute. There are some scientists who don't like about the nerdy stereotypes, but one thing that I really like about the show is that everyone on it is smart.
Right.
And they're valued because they're smart. And their intelligence is not something to be seen as a drawback. It's seen as something to aspire to. And so, and these people really enjoy their work. And so I like the show just for that alone.
Do you ever pause the screen and try to figure out the equations on the boards?
No, but I know that they're right because I know the guy, David Salzberg, who is the science consultant for show.
Nice.
Responsible for getting that stuff right every week. And actually, we've emailed back and forth sometimes about, you know, some oddball physics things that they can do. So I've heard that I'm told that the writers of the show have my book in their writing room. So
very
that's
cool.
Very cool also.
Yep. So, and that brings us back to John's question. I'm sorry, John.
Oh, it's okay. So why don't you tell us, you know, if you want to give us a little brief bit about the physics of superheroes first, and then we can get into the new book. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the first book?
Sure. So the first book, while it's not a textbook, kind of grew out of a class that I created at the University of Minnesota. Back in 2001, I created a freshman seminar that was originally called Everything I Know About Science I Learned from Reading Comic Books, and which to my colleagues, that they said that kind of explained a lot. And this was a real physics class that covered everything from Isaac Newton to the transistor, but there wasn't an inclined plane or pulley in sight. All the examples came from superhero comic books, and as much as possible, those cases where the superheroes would get their science right. Certainly the superpowers themselves of the heroes and villains is physically impossible. Oh, wait, spoiler alert. And I don't see my job as just being like Dr. No or Professor Grump, where I say, oh, well, this could never happen, and this is impossible, and what's the deal with the Hulk's pants anyway? And so what we would do is we'd grant a suspension of disbelief, a one-time miracle exemption from the laws of nature, and say, well, if you were super strong or could stretch like a rubber band or could run at super speed like the Flash or Dash from the movie The Incredibles, could you run across the ocean or up the side of a building? Could you drag bullets, catch bullets in midair, drag people behind you in your wake? All things these characters are shown doing in the comics, using their super speed, all that are correct from a physics point of view once you make that suspension of disbelief. So the class did well. I got a fair amount of media attention when the first Spider-Man movie came out. And it led to hundreds of emails from students and teachers and people long out of college who liked this idea of teaching physics using superheroes, asked if I had a book, which eventually led to my writing a book, which is now in its second edition.
Nice.
Great. And, you know, why don't you tell us a little bit about how that led, because I'm pretty sure that book led to your advisory role in the Watchmen movie.
Right. So that's exactly right. I was actually out at a conference of librarians in Denver, and I met someone who worked for the National Academy of Sciences.
That's where I live.
And she gave my name to someone else there because the National Academy of Sciences was setting up a program where they were going to matchmake academics and Hollywood. There were a growing interest from Hollywood to speak to scientists as they were developing scripts, developing their TV shows or movies. But they didn't know who to call. If you want to talk to someone about time travel, okay, maybe a physicist, but which physics department, which physics professor would you want to speak with? So they would act as the clearinghouse and the middlemen. And before they even launched the program, they got a request for a consultant for a superhero movie they had never heard of. And I got a call, and they said, well, would you be interested in doing this for this movie? I don't know what it is, but it's called Watchmen. And, so, you know, as you know, for comic book fans, it's like saying about movies, have you ever heard of this movie? It's called Citizen Kane.
Right.
So when I was done vibrating like a gong, I said, yeah.
And of course, part of you is going, God, don't screw it up. Don't screw it up. Don't screw it up.
Well, actually, that was very interesting. They sent me the script. It's kind of interesting. Every page has this giant watermark on the script, James Cacalia, so that if it ever showed up on the internet, they know exactly where it came from. And that's exactly right. I was reading it, and it was kind of interesting because before I started, I said, all right, let me, as an exercise, let me figure out what they're going to drop because you can't cram it all into a three-hour movie. And I was surprised at how much was in there.
Right.
And pretty much what was in the script that I saw was what the finished film was. Though he actually the ending is better than the script. And this was the script that existed just a few months before they were ready to start filming. But in that – but so anyway, not to get too far off on that. And it was interesting. What do they need me for? Because it's – unlike – making an Iron Man movie or a Spider-Man movie where you could either write an original story or there's, you know, 40, 50 years worth of comics that you can pick from. Watchmen is really a self-contained entity. It's one graphic novel. And on set, you couldn't take 10 steps and not run into a copy of the graphic novel. They were using it so much as a reference point that if I were to say that something was wrong from a science point of view, but it was in the comic book, well, if they have a choice between taking off a million Watchmen fans or one physics professor from Minnesota, I know what choice I'd make, and I'm the physics professor from Minnesota. But nevertheless, they wanted to know like how Dr. Manhattan's powers might work. The blue glow, the teleportation, what would be the quantum mechanics behind this? And Alex McDowell, the production designer, put it, he said, we want to know what's around the corner of a long hallway, even if the audience doesn't go down that corridor. Because the more that they can make all the little things right, the audience will, because the more they'll be able to create a realistic fake reality. Any moment that the audience is looking at something and saying, that's not a physics lab, or that's not the way a physicist would behave, or that looks wrong, is a moment that they're not paying attention to the story. And so this is I think, what's really – this is the interest from Hollywood's point of view. They want to get – they want to make better films.
So J.J. Abrams isn't part of that group apparently.
Well, I don't know. He's never spoken to me.
Red matter.
I don't go to the movies with a pad of paper and a calculator and say, ooh, my physics sense is tingling. But rather, I go and I want to say, it's like if they get something right and I catch it, it's like catching an inside joke.
Sure.
And now, of course, I say, ooh, I could use this in my class or in a talk or so. In the Iron Man film, the first one in 2008, at one point we see Robert Downey Jr. doing some soldering as he's building like the Mark II Iron Man suit back in when he's back from Afghanistan. And he's using the same soldering iron that I have in my laboratory. And he's doing it right. And I'm probably the only person who got excited at Iron Man for the soldering.
Well, and then you had the flip side is when, you know, when they get something horribly, horribly wrong.
Right.
People talk about it forever.
Talk about it forever when it's so egregious that even the non-professional scientists catch it. It takes everyone right out of the movie.
Yep.
And you also harm yourself on repeat sales and DVDs and everything else. You get bad word of mouth. And so nobody wants – and so that's why when you see Robert Downey Jr. doing that soldering, it looks like he knows what he's doing because he's doing it correctly. And so you don't think there's Robert Downey Jr. playing a part. You look, say, hey, there's Tony Stark building the Iron Man suit.
Right.
So it's part of that, getting the audience to buy into it. So that way, if you buy into that, then other things the characters do that stretch reality a little bit, people are willing to give a little and go along with and enjoy the film and tell their friends to go see it, and everyone's happy.
The famous one that sticks out in my mind, and not necessarily, you know, everyone who went and saw Jurassic Park caught this, but a lot of people caught this and it bothered them. And it was when the girl sits down at the computer that has a graphical user interface, and mm-hmm. she says, "Oh, this is Unix. I know this."
Right. Yes.
And you know, anybody who did anything with Unix knew there was no graphic user interface. It was all right. Prompt. And so, you know, that's one of those things that just sticks with you and kind of lasts forever.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of interesting because talking to some geologist friends of mine, what really rubbed them raw was the fact that the atmosphere of the Earth 65 million years ago was profoundly different from what it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these dinosaurs should have had major respiratory problems.
Yep.
So, which is kind of interesting. And that's the actual interesting aspects of you looking at the science. You, even when you make the suspension of disbelief, it then lets you delve a little deeper into issues like, what else would you need to get right? Or what else would you need to make it work? If you could run at super speed, you want to avoid air drag. You want to avoid you need friction between your shoes and the ground, but too much friction and you start to build up a electrical charge. You notice this sometimes when you get out of your automobile and close the car door and you give yourself a shock. The friction, the rubbing, also can sometimes involve transfers of charge. And the Flash should have this large charge. He's running very fast. He's an electrical current that creates magnetic fields. He should be pulling every piece of metal he passes behind him and dragging it behind him in his wake. So you can look at this, and then by discussing these things, it's a fun way of talking about things like Ampere's law or, you know, contact electrification, phenomena that you discuss in class, but here you're doing it in a fun context.
And I remember the Flash TV show that they did in the 90s, they actually played a little bit with what his speed actually, you know, the wave or the after effect of, you know, he's running at full speed and his clothes get shredded.
That's exactly right. And that was used as a justification for the red suit.
Yep.
That it was actually like a prototype Soviet deep sea diving suit that could withstand the high velocity shear.
Right.
And so that's exactly right. So those are the little things that you can put in, and it helps the audience. It makes it makes for a better show.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Now, Jim, why don't we transition to talking about your new book? Okay. And you know, it's funny. I read it, and one of the conceits of the book, this is kind of an ongoing thing that Patrick has. As we do another podcast called the SF Signal Podcast, and one of the regulars on that who does some science fiction reviews, she's also a scientist for NASA.
An engineer
for NASA. And Patrick bugs her almost every episode, always asking, "Where's my jetpack? Where's my jetpack?" And right. I think your book addresses this. So why don't you tell Patrick why he doesn't have his jetpack yet?
Right. Yeah. Patrick, we all have jetpacks. We're just not letting you have one.
Right. No, you know, it's funny because she did this thing at World Fantasy, and it was this deeply, it was like critical theory and science fiction and fantasy. I mean, it was like this thing that was so far over my head, it wasn't even funny. And when the moderator said, you know, we've got like 2 minutes left, are there any questions? I had to fight the urge because I really did want to stand up and say, yes, I have a question for Karen. Where's my jetpack?
Well, here's the deal. You're absolutely right. We're in the 21st century now. We were promised jetpacks and flying cars, and we got cell phones and laptop computers instead. And what the writers of these science fiction pulps and comic books missed was that they expected that we'd have a revolution in energy when what we got was a revolution in information.
Right.
It takes an awful lot of energy to lift a person or an automobile up into the air and to keep it there. And for an automobile, nearly all the energy is used in lifting it up so that there's practically no stored chemical energy in the fuel tank left over to go anywhere, which kind of defeats the whole purpose of a car. And so to get that energy, if you're going to use chemical reactants, you're pretty much kind of limited by the atoms that we have and the molecular interactions they have. You could go nuclear, but very few people are willing to have an unlicensed nuclear power pack on their backs who aren't the Ghostbusters. So,
you know, it's just occurred to me we really haven't had a completely successful test of this equipment.
I blame myself.
So do I.
Well, no sense worrying about it now.
Why worry? Each of us is wearing an unlicensed nuclear accelerator on his back.
Yep. Let's get ready. Switch me on.
So that's the problem. Where information, you're only limited by basically people's cleverness of how to encode the information and what would constitute a signal. And so it's kind of interesting that within the months of each other, in 1926, Hugo Gernsback starts publishing the first pulp magazine devoted exclusively to science fiction, Amazing Stories. Also publishing in 1926, Erwin Schrödinger, publishing the Schrödinger equation that would be the foundation for modern quantum mechanics. Hmm. And so these two visions of the future take off, like I say, within months of each other in 1926, one to the future of fantasy and the other to the future of the world that we have today. Without quantum mechanics is the branch of physics that involves how atoms interact with each other, the properties of atoms, and how they interact with light. Once you have this understanding of quantum mechanics, a generation later in the 1940s and 50s, scientists were able to invent the laser and the transistor. A generation later still, you get iPods, DVDs, cell phones, laptop computers, television remote controls. Everything, I'm sure you'll agree, without which life is not worth living. None of these are possible without the transistor or the laser, neither of which is possible without quantum mechanics. Schrödinger is not trying to make a CD player or an iPod. If you ask him, nice equation, Erwin, what's it good for? He's not going to say, well, if you want to store music in a compact digital format. But really, without the curiosity-driven research from two generations ago, the world we live in would be profoundly different. I mean, we'd have computers. There were computers before the transistor. They used vacuum tubes as the logic elements. They're big, they're bulky, they generate a lot of heat. You want a big computer, a powerful computer, you then need more vacuum tubes. So they'd be the size of a room. Very few entities aside from the government and large corporations could afford to have such computers, so there'd be very little need to link them all together. So you wouldn't have the internet, you wouldn't have the World Wide Web without quantum mechanics.
I thought Al Gore created the internet.
He helped the funding, he helped support it. He never said that he created the internet.
The book is really, it touches on so many different subjects. And the one that I really enjoyed, kind of being such a big fan of science fiction, is how scientists have influenced fiction writers, and thereby fiction writers would influence another generation of scientists, and sort of back and forth. Can you speak to that for a moment?
Sure, absolutely. Yes, that's exactly right. In The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, I also use science fiction pulps and comic books as illustrations of the physics principles underlying quantum mechanics and its applications. A really amazing story involves the atom bomb. One of the first references to atomic bombs in literature is in an H.G. Wells novel, The World Set Free, that was published in 1914. So 30 years before the Manhattan Project, H.G. Wells is writing a novel about an atomic world war that devastates Europe, where atomic planes are dropping atomic bombs on different capitals. Wells is probably inspired to write this by a series of popular science books published by Frederick Soddy. Soddy was a collaborator with Ernest Rutherford, who was the discoverer of the atomic nucleus. And Soddy wrote these books about the possibility of atomic energy being unleashed. But at that time, it was purely speculation. Nobody knew how to actually do these experiments and do this. But it made a big impression on Wells, and he wrote his novel. Wells's fictional novel, in turn, made a big impression on Leo Szilard, a Hungarian physicist who was actually the first person to conceive of a nuclear chain reaction. And he thought of this even a few years before uranium was split. And Szilard is the person who wrote the letter, signed by Albert Einstein, that convinced President FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, to start the Manhattan Project. And so Szilard was inspired by Wells's novel. He says this very explicitly, that was what gave him the notion. He put the bug in his head and the fear, because he knew the scientists that had remained behind in Germany, and he knew how smart they were. And so the fear was that if he could see this, they could see it, and that they would be working on atomic weapons. You combine this with the V-2 missiles, and World War II might have a very different outcome.
Wow.
And so he is the main driver that sets the Manhattan Project in motion, inspired by a novel, inspired by a popular science book.
That kind of reminds me, there used to be a show on like the Discovery Channel or TLC or something, and I want to say it was a scientist, and he would talk about the connections and how they kind of,
yes,
you know,
Burke was his name. John, I'm not sure if it's not Jonathan, I think. Might be Jonathan Burke, but Burke, and it was Connections. Yes.
Yes, that was a fascinating show. I loved that.
Yeah. And so here's kind of an example of that. You also see, you know, what first tipped me off on this is I was reading a collection of old Buck Rogers newspaper strips from 1929, and they casually make reference to an atomic torpedo. And I'm thinking, why the heck are they talking about atomic torpedoes, you know, years before the Manhattan Project, and acting as if, oh yeah, of course the readership is going to know what this is, know that this is more powerful than a regular torpedo. And that's what I was talking to historians of science, and they said, oh, you know, you want to go back to H.G. Wells. But there's lots of these references, lots of these mentions. I found in an old Doc Savage pulp adventure, he casually cites the Schrodinger theory of the atom and talks about Schrodinger has shown that the atom can be considered pulsating spheres of electricity. I say, well, that's actually kind of a fairly accurate and somewhat poetic way of describing what Schrodinger's equation does indeed say. So it's kind of interesting to find these little nuggets buried throughout literature.
Well, sure. Well, I mean, there's a reason that the first, you know, Motorola cell phones were flip phones that looked like the communicators from Star Trek.
Absolutely. You know?
And the tablet PCs now, they kind of look like the little handheld computers that were on Star Trek.
The tricorders and those types of things. Absolutely. No, though the only problem is that Star Trek wasn't imaginative enough. You would never here in 2010 buy a cell phone that could do only what a Star Trek communicator could do. right? It only makes calls. It only
unless you're my mom. That's what she wants. She's tired of all the other stuff.
Right. Well, there is a little bit of that, you know. But, you know, there's no web, there's no photos, there's no texting. It's just ship to ship.
Well, you know, you had Dick Tracy had his little radio watch.
He had his two-way wrist radio in 1946 or 1944, I think, a couple of years before the transistor was invented. And when they flipped it open in one of the panels once, you see there's all these little tiny vacuum tubes and stuff inside the radio. Then in the 1964, he had a two-way wrist TV. In the 1980s, he had a two-way wrist computer with an LCD screen. And so Tracy's been always ahead of the curve for that, as far as that's concerned.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, Jim, I feel like we could talk about this all night, but I know we have to let you go.
I could.
Yeah, I know. It's really fascinating stuff. You know, we'll have to have you at some point later on. We'll have to have you on the SF Signal podcast. And we'll have to have our friend Karen Burnham, who's the engineer at NASA, and just let you guys go at it for for a while. I think that'd be a great discussion. But
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, so let's, you know, to wrap it up here, so your first book, The Physics of Superheroes, is on its second printing. Your new book, The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, is out now. Is there anything else that you'd like people to know about that you're doing?
Well, let's see. If you're going to be in Seattle on, let me just double check the date here. It's November 16th. I'll be speaking at the Town Hall in Seattle. November 19th, I'm going to be at Arizona State in the physics department giving a public lecture also. And so and you can go to YouTube and watch a couple of videos that we made in support of the book. You might enjoy. They we did them in the style of the old 1950s science educational film strips. So in one of them just gives kind of like an introduction to the book. And the second one, Lesson 6, the laser, death rays, and DVDs, explains in about 4 minutes how a laser works and the difference between CDs and DVDs and Blu-ray. So it's the kind of stuff that's in The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics, trying to explain basically how the world works in a fun and accessible way.
That sounds great. Do you have a website, or do you do any social media?
Yep. If you go to www.kakalios.com, that's K-A-K-A-L-I-O-S, or physicsofsuperheroes.com, they will take you to sites that can give you information on both books.
Wow, that sounds great. Well, Jim, thanks so much for joining us. You know, for my little plugs at the end here, you can get my songs, johnanilio.bandcamp.com. You can follow me at twitter.com/johnanilio. And also, you know, kind of a nice sort of balance between having Jim on this week. Next week, we will have a science fiction author, Kevin J. Anderson. So kind of nice back and forth there. Patrick, what do you have going on this week?
Tons of stuff over on the blog, atfmb.com. Most of it is World Fantasy Convention themed this week. So by the time you hear this, that'll be good. Just go check that out. I should also have a post up by the time this airs over at Grasping for the Wind. And then I don't know what else.
Okay, well, that sounds good. Well, once again, Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, we'll see you next week, everybody.
I'm staring at my laptop screen, scrolling through the feeds. I'm subscribed to 100 blogs, but there's still nothing to read. While flicking tabs in Firefox, a theme seems to repeat. Grab a book from off your shelf and find page 123. So turn to page 123. Write the fifth sentence that you see. So turn to page 123, 'cause that seems to be the latest meme.
Freakonomics by Don Tapscott and Anthony Williams. I open to page 123 and do what must be done. It reads firms will still need to invest resources in internal R&D to be able to recognize a commercial opportunity. Yeah, turn to page 123. But it just doesn't make much sense to me.
Yeah,
turn to page 123. If that seems to be the latest meme. Yeah, it seems to be the latest meme. Wonder what the next meme will be. Not even sure what that.